Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist from the 8th of September 2008. The cover is The Delusion Is You. And as usual, I'll read through this. What is it? I've done a fair amount of podcasting today on a book from the 1930s, but this will be New Scientist, and of course the aim is to read fluently and well for as long as possible. Like looking in a mirror, we're not as unique. Lots of species can recognize themselves. We like to think that human minds are special. One sign of our superiority is self-awareness, which is generally seen as the pinnacle of consciousness. Only a select group of species have passed the test of being able to recognize themselves in a mirror. Most, including elephants, apes, dolphins, are notoriously smart. But now, a scrappy little fish, a cleaner wassail, has joined the ranks. What are we to make of this? Admittedly, the mirror test is a questionable way of probing the minds of other animals. But finding does fit with an emerging idea that the ability to recognize oneself is more related to an animal's lifestyle than to its brain size. Self-awareness is likely to occur in creatures whose survival is dependent on reading the minds of others. In fact, by this way of thinking, it's nothing more than an accidental byproduct of evolution, a simulation created in the brain, or even just a ball of mirrors giving the illusion of complexity. The cleaner wrasse lives on coral reefs and provides a service by nibbling parasites off the scales of the bigger fish, a delicate relationship that may require insight into the minds of its clients. Such a theory of mind has long been seen as another cornerstone of human mental superiority. The possibility that fishes possesses it is not, however, the only threat to our human exceptionalism. It may not be long before computers give us a run for their money too. Standard touchstones. CRISPR AI. Researchers have created a set of tests to look for the theory of mind and artificial intelligence. And some systems are on the verge of passing. We probably don't need to worry about robots that can recognize themselves in mirrors, but we might get but we might want to be more open to the idea of human intelligence isn't quite as special as we think. A note from the editor. Here's the editor, Emily Wilson. Hello, Emily. And there are only 2 weeks ago until New Scientist Live. The four-day show is a unique mixture of fascinating talks from scientists and an amazing array of exhibits, from slime Olympics to virtual reality tour of your brain. It's an enormous joyful celebration of ideas. And we call it the world's greatest science festival, because we really think it is. Last year, more than 30,000 people came in the doors of Excel in London, and it was a privilege for us to get to know so many of you, more than 30,000. If you're in striking distance from these dates, 20th to 23rd of September this year, please come along. I'm most looking forward to introducing astronaut Tim Peake's talk on Thursday, but whatever day you come, there'll be something brilliant going on. Check out the program at New Scientist. Okay, thank you, Emily. I might write a letter to you about my New Scientist experience. It's gone a long time. Okay, reading 3 minutes in. Treasured artifacts lost. There's a picture of the Brazilian museum all gutted out. Brazil's oldest and most important scientific museum was gutted by fire on the 2nd of September. Within hours, the blaze destroyed many priceless scientific artifacts and collections gathered since the National Museum was founded in 1818. Which really goes, eggs in one basket. And, this is my real thought. The items potentially lost include a massive Bienego meteorite weighing 5,260 kilograms. I can't see how you can burn a meteorite to the ground. The loser, 12,000-year-old human skeleton, the oldest in the Americas. Based in Rio de Janeiro, the museum has impeccable collections of scientific artifacts, specimens, and records in geology and botany, biology, paleontology, and zoology, as well as priceless cultural and anthropological artifacts. Almost 90% of the 20 million items were thought to have been lost. It's incalculable to lose the collection of the National Museum, said Marco Temer, Brazil's president, in a statement reported to Rio Times. 200 years of work, research and knowledge were lost. Media sources report the fire began between the museum closing and the usual as usual on Sunday, the 2nd of September at 7:30 p.m. Some reports claim that two key fire hydrants on the site were dry, preventing firefighters from tackling the fires at early stages. Other reports say that successive governments had allowed the museum to fall into disrepair. The Brazilian government says it's now seeking a corporate funding to rebuild the museum. Officials also seeking international help. Speaking to UNESCO, the cultural agency of the United Nations. Many thoughts in my head going through about fighting fires. Obviously, we have massive fires ripped through Australia up to the Blue Mountains all the time. American dream is slipping away. Poor Yanks. Is it the American dream that anyone can become prosperous through hard work, irrespective of their status and birth? But reality is different. This is sparking brain waves in me in terms of we have a sort of a de facto class system of squatocracy. The socioeconomic status of someone in the US is more strongly influenced by that of their parents than previously thought. Michael Hoot of New York University looked at the data from 21,000 people each given a socioeconomic index SEI score, a measure of paying credentials ranking from 0 to 100, with 0 representing the lowest in society. The data included a questionnaire and answers and helped establish the SEI scores of other people's parents. The American Dream suggests that anyone can achieve a high SEI score, but how it found otherwise. It turned out that there was a strong linear relation between someone's SEI scores and that of their parents. Early studies have hinted that at such intergeneration persistence, says Hart, but not to such a strong degree as his findings suggest. This is an interesting one to hear. The race to save Mars rover Opportunity. Time is running out for NASA's Opportunity rover. A dust storm that has been raging in Mars since early June is starting to subside, potentially giving the rover enough sunlight to charge its batteries. But on 30th August, NASA set a 45-day deadline before it gives up trying to wake it. Opportunity rover runs solely on solar power, so a dust storm like this one, which has blocked out more than 99% of the sunlight of Mars' surface, can be catastrophic. The last signal received from the Opportunity was on the 10th of June. Since then, it has been in sleep mode, using any power it has left to keep the batteries warm enough to survive the frigid surface. Now, the planet's encircling storm has begun to clear. Rover operators are sending the Opportunity's wake-up calls 3 times a week, with orders to send back a beep if it's alive. The hope is that the sleep mode has kept the batteries safe, and the Martian dust devil will soon come along and blow the sand off the rover's solar panels, allowing it to charge up again. So a dust devil afterwards. So it's dust, and then there's dust of dust. Health chief... Health chiefs in England this week launched an online heart age test, which aimed to reveal people's risk of heart attack or stroke. The Public Health England, PHE, says that if the heart is older than their age, they are increased risk and should consider diet and lifestyle changes. Okay, well, age is really easy for people to understand, isn't it? PHE says about 1.9 million who have already tried the test, 78% had hearts older than their age. Well, that's more about the test than anything else. They should compare it to other ones. In 14%, their hearts were 10 years older, but critics say the test, which asks simple physical and lifestyle questions, could create unfounded alarm by basing estimates on incomplete data. It asks accurate measurements of blood pressure and cholesterol, but if these are not available, it seems to assume abnormal values, potentially overestimating heart age. I just entered this as a 30-year-old with no risk factors and told me to get cholesterol and blood pressure tests, tweeted Margaret McCartney, a family doctor in Glasgow. Where is the evidence of benefit? Okay, that's the end of that one. Doesn't say very much. Crunch time for Ebola in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. Warzone may thwart efforts to halt virus, reports Deborah McKenzie. The Ebola outbreak in Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, has reached a critical juncture. It seems to be subsiding after striking 121 people and killing 81 on the 2nd September. But the coming days may be crucial, says Tedros Ghebreyesus, head of the World Health Organization, WHO. That is partly because the outbreak in North Kivu province is a war torn east of the DRC. They're fighting by more than east. Fighting more than 50 armed groups put many areas off limits. 50 groups, my godfather. To stop the virus spreading, medical teams must isolate, vaccinate anyone who's had contact with the infected person, and all people they in turn come into contact with. But this is two generations out. But the teams can't work much more than 30 kilometres from the epidemic centre city of Beni. Worse, the UN's International Organization for Migration, IOM, has found that people in the region are highly mobile, with traders and miners transiting to Uganda and Rwanda, and 1 million people have been displaced by violence. Such high population mobility, plus a slow medical response, caused an Ebola outbreak in West Africa to mushroom into an unprecedented epidemic. They killed more than 11,000 people in 2014. This time, the response has not been slow. The outbreak was recognized on the 1st of August, only a week after an Ebola epidemic on the other side of the DRC had been halted. A week later, teams at North Kivu were vaccinating. The selective ring vaccination of contacts of known cases, then their contacts, makes the best use of the limited vaccine by containing the virus spreading from known cases. It seems to be working on the 1st of September with 5,462 contact vaccinated, who reported 13 new cases the previous week, down from 25 and 35 the week before that. If that continues, the 300,000 doses of vaccine available worldwide should be more than enough to contain this epidemic. But epidemics can hit tipping points and soar exponentially. Stopping that requires stopping all the chains of transmission, says Mark Ryan, head of the emergency response at WHO. Moreover, Ebola epidemics come in waves. The next surge could be incubating or invisible in violent no-go areas. Worryingly, 4 of the new cases reported last week were not from unknown chains of transmission, so there are unknown chains out there. They may be hard to find. The IOM has used its data to choose the 34 most important transport hubs where people leave the region. The Congolese authorities have so far checked 840,000 travellers there for symptoms. My God, that's a pretty active thing. It is also mapped highly vulnerable spots such as popular markets and churches with strong connections to the outbreak zone for closer monitoring. But the IOM is only able to monitor a relatively safe zone. Quote, the news of two confirmed cases from Oicha is extremely distressing because the area is most entirely surrounded by armed militants, says Michelle Gale, the US-based International Rescue Committee. Last week, a medical team with a heavy UN military escort vaccinated 97 contacts of 2 infected people in Oicha, discovered only because one travelled to Benin. Anyone in the area around Oicha has not been reached. The WHO last week decided to test 3 antiviral drugs randomly chosen patients. No one will get the placebo, so the trials can't establish formally how much better the drugs are than getting no drugs, but they can compare the 3. 2 people received the ZMAP, a cocktail of antibodies and immune proteins that attack Ebola virus. It showed promise in 2014, but it's hard to administer and must be stored below at -880°C, the nitrogen, which is difficult in the DRC. 5 had had remdesivir, a molecule that blocks the infection process. The big surprise is that the 13 have been given MAB14, an antibody of a survivor of the 1995 Ebola epidemic in Kihiwit, DRC, which can be kept in a refrigerator and needs only one simple injection. Last year, a WHO panel judged it too untested to use in epidemics, but the US National Institutes of Health has since rushed through safety trials in humans. Two people on it have recovered, says WHO, but it's not yet known if the drug helped. Okay. So, if everyone died, it wouldn't help, would it? A graveyard is bad omen for penguins. Michael Marshall. Mummified penguins have been found littering the ground of Antarctica. The birds seem to have died during two bouts of extreme weather over the past 1,000 years. The conditions are expected to become more common as a result of climate change, making mass die-offs more likely. The birds found on the Long Peninsula in East Antarctica by researchers at Li Yuan Sun at the University of Science Technology in China, Hefei. It's unusual to find dead penguins, but those on Long Peninsula, mainly chicks, are especially numerous, with up to 15 per square meter and hundreds overall. They consist of well-preserved, dehydrated mummies, the researchers write in the paper. All are Adelie penguins, which only live in Antarctica. They currently breed in Antarctica summer on about 250 sites, forming a huge colonies near the coast. To find out what happened on the Long Peninsula, some team used carbon dating to estimate the age of the corpses. They also studied the sediments, which contain excrements of nest material. They found the penguins have lived for at least 3,900 years, but most of the deaths occurred in two periods around 750 and 200 years ago. The colonies were abandoned after each time a little new settlement was laid down in later centuries. The cause seems to have been unusually heavy snow and rain over the several decades. The team found evidence of floods that carried sediments and corpses downhill and signs of erosion. Rain is a lethal threat, said Jan Robert Codd of French National Centre for Scientific Research. Quote, the chicks especially are not made for wet weather. He says hypothermia is a risk. Meanwhile, snow makes it hard for the parents to find the pebbles to make the nest. And if it melts to milk waters, it can drown the chicks. The cause of the wet weather is probably a shift in the southern annular mode, a pattern of winds in the Southern Ocean that can send extra damp air to the East Antarctica. Climate change is likely to make it more frequently. Adelies are widespread, so can handle occasional disasters, says Steve Embassy of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. But they face increasingly pressures. In April, Embassy published a study of the largest modern Adelie colony in Cape Adare. Quote, sea level rise is going to displace hundreds of thousands of penguins there and Cape Hallett within the next 30 to 50 years, as those beaches are gradually inundated, he says. Robert Cudet has detailed disastrous 2013-14 breeding season, when no chicks survived in a majority of the colony on Petrel Island in East Antarctica. Unusually heavy snowfall killed them, combined with weak winds that failed to break up the sea ice, preventing adults from catching enough food. And it wasn't a one-off. In 2017, quote, we had a second massive breeding failure in the same place. According to the International Union of Conservation of Nature, adult penguins are at low risk of extinction, but Robert Cudet says repeatedly breeding failures on Petrel Islands are a bad sign. The solution is to limit climate change as much as possible, he says. He could also set up a protected areas to, quote, prevent other threats from superimposing on the climate ones. Okay, this is by Leah Crane. Star explosions could explain misfit galaxies. The dark matter in small galaxies has been driving cosmologists a headache. Blowing up A few stars may provide the solution. Dark matter is thought to make up most of the matter in the universe and should be found mixed in with regular matter in galaxies. The standard model of cosmology, called the Lambda CMD, predicts that the density of dark matter should increase as you move towards the center of a galaxy. But some dwarf galaxies didn't get the memo. They have a constant density of dark matter. That seems a minor wrinkle, but it can't be, if it can't be explained within the Lambda CMD, it could do a blow to our understanding of dark matter. Quote, the implication of these very subtle emissions are large, so people have argued a lot over them. This is Mark Geller of Yale University, who wasn't involved in the latest work. Star formation is one potential explanation. Some stars are born after old ones die in explosive supernovas, which sends matter flying. Bursts of such stars formation in small galaxies might blow some dark matter towards the edges, smoothing out the distribution. Well, who knows what dark matter is and how it can blow? Justin Ridd, the University of Surrey, and UK and his colleagues used measurements of the mass of the centre dwarf galaxies to test the idea. They picked out samples of two different types of galaxies, eight that stopped forming stars long ago and eight that are still forming stars or only stopped relatively recently. They found the galaxies with high rates of stellar formation had less dark matter in their centre, pointing to more uniform distribution that matches the idea that the star's formation moves mass towards the edges of the galaxy, which shifts the dark matter outwards. It's a good sign for Lambda CDM if the result stands up. So that's interesting. How can an explosion push dark matter? If we can't feel any dark matter, we can't detect it. How does a star blowing up produce it? I don't know. Drone could fly indefinitely by laser power, by David Hamming. The US Army is taking a wireless recharging to new heights by using lasers to power small drones in midair. Small multicopters, flying vehicles with several rotating blades, have proven valuable to the military for intelligence gathering, but they are power hungry, meaning that their flying time is limited to half an hour or less. Now the US Army's Communication and Electronics Research and Development Center, based in Maryland, is developing a power beaming system with a combination of lasers and efficient photovoltaic cells. It's just, it's just making me really think. That's trying to think of the different solutions. Small multi-copters, flying vehicles with several rotating blades, have proven valuable for military intelligence gathering, but they are power hungry, meaning that their flying time is limited to half an hour or less. Now the US Army's Communication and Electronics Research Development Engineering Center, based in Maryland, is developing a power beaming system with a combination of laser and efficient voltaic cells. The aim is to provide enough power from 500 meters away to keep the drone patrolling indefinitely above a base, flying over a convoy or for its entire route. The system works by firing lasers at photovoltaic cells in the drone, which converts the light to electricity. Yeah, you know what? I really think that's sort of an aim for mirrors, isn't it? Well, I think you hit a large mirror, and the mirror then gets feedback to go into a much smaller photovoltaic cell. This is my overall view of how it would work best. The major challenge we see is thermal management, says engineer William Morley. Any energy that's not converted to electricity comes heat, so there's a risk of melting or burning the drone. The problem is overcome by developing accurate beam control and ensuring the excess heat can be dissipated. Well, yeah, this is my exact point, that you want it to hit a mirror and then reflect up at a good angle. So one of the things is that if you've got the drone a distance away, you want to have a drop-down mirror that picks it up and then tweaks it abroad into a really finely controlled area. This is my view. Okay. The plan looks technically feasible, according to David Anderson at the University of Glasgow. However, providing its safety is another matter, given the potential risks from high-energy beams such as eye or skin damage. Quote, the challenge is how you can convince the regulatory authorities that it's safe, well, not in a war zone, especially if you have to persuade them that the laser will not miss the drone energy collector panel when charging. The team aims to demonstrate the first working system in 2019. Well, you need this feedback system that a guide laser goes in, and only when the guide laser is actually gone in, you then send in a big wallop of power. That would be my way of doing it. So you can guarantee, if it goes off, the laser switches off. DNA, especially if you have some retroreflectors either side of it. DNA editing before birth may bring it healthy, so that light is beamed back to you. Yeah, well, that's, you can make a really dumb system. Making dozens of changes to DNA in human egg and sperm cells for very early embryos could dramatically extend the lifespan of offspring. Yippo! This is an article by famous Michael Lepage. He loves CRISPR. Is he going to mention CRISPR? I don't know. According to the first attempt to quantify potential benefits of germline genome editing, quote, this shows that we could potentially use germline editing to make us all resistant to diseases of old age, says biomedical ethicist Christopher Gingell of the University of Melbourne, Melbourne, Australia, who has not involved in the study. It's already possible to prevent genetic diseases caused by single mutations such as cystic fibrosis by screening IVF embryos before implantation, for instance. But we all carry thousands of gene variants that don't inevitably lead to diseases, oh my god, Father, yet affect our risk of developing them. Changing one wouldn't be a big impact, but changing many could potentially add years to the lives and could otherwise be cut short. Especially as people get this, it's all cured. You knew you were all cured. Would that affect your personality, that you'd be a real wanker? This may be possible in the next few decades, says Roman Theo Oilink, a computational biologist at the University of Auckland, New Zealand. For instance, here we go. CRISPR genome editing has been used to make multiple changes to animal genomes. Oilink, who looked at the gene variants known as SNPs that affect the risk of developing diseases of old age, including heart disease, type 2 diabetes, stroke, Alzheimer's, osteoarthritis, and some cancers. From these, it is possible to estimate whether a person has a greater or lower risk of developing the disease. Oilink modeled what would happen. This is cause and effect. But you may do it, but you might not get the effect. Model what would happen if those higher than average risk had undergone genome editing before birth and reduced their risk to average. This would mean altering dozens of SNP, even hundreds of those. It's sort of like taking the defect notice off a motorcycle and saying, it's fixed, mate. Go and drive really crazy because I've taken those defect marks off your motorcycle. The findings suggest the results would be dramatic. What? Ooh, that's the thing. So the findings aren't the thing. The find that's a person on average living many years longer before developing some disease. The benefits could be greatest for cancer. Those treated would live 2 decades longer on average before developing breast, prostate, colorectal cancers, and their lifetime risk would be more than halved, even if they lived 10 years longer. However, as Oilink acknowledges, his conclusions depend on several assumptions. One is that we have correctly identified SNPs that affect disease risk. In reality, there is still a huge uncertainty. Quote, I don't think we are there yet. I'm not sure we'll ever be, says geneticist Helen O'Neill, the University College of London. She points out that the effect of gene variants can depend on environment and other gene variants and may prove impossible to accurately predict. The other assumption is that altering SNPs has no side effects, says Ali Tokami of this group's research institute in La Jolla, California. Quote, there is often a trade-off to be had. You've reduced your risk of coronary artery disease, but you may have increased your risk of some other disorder, he says. There are also major practical problems, says O'Neill. You can't know what SMPs an embryo will inherit until it forms, so you can't work out the risk in advance. But if you wait until this stage, it may be too late to edit the genome. Olick thinks the answer would be to use synthetic genomes, rebuilding the genomes from scratch and correcting the disease-causing variant. And we're not cloning Mac. This is not yet possible with large genomes like us, but Olick is confident it will be. Good on you, Olick. O-L-Yink. Quote, it's a purely technological issues, which isn't everything, and these are always solved. I'm glad you're happy with that, mate. Okay. Question on 30 minutes and see how we go. This is by Leah Crane. Mystery cold spot found on Europa. Beautiful picture of Europa. Beautiful moon of Jupiter. Remember, got to remember is... There's a weird cold spot on Europa, and nobody knows what it is. The first full thermal ice mat of Jupiter's icy moon has thrown up a spot about 300 kilometers across that seems colder than its surroundings. We don't have enough data on the area to figure out why. Well, either it's radiating faster, or it's not receiving the same heat. Oh, well, okay. The Samantha Turner of California Institute of Technology and her colleagues use the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, a set of more than 60 radio telescopes in Chile, to measure the heat radiating from Europa's surface in a set of 4 overlapping thermal images. It represents the first full temperature map of the icy moon. We weren't so interested in cold spots. We're more interested in hot spots because theirs could indicate geological activity, said Turnbull. But we saw one cold spot repeated in 2 of the images. Spot's about 9 degrees cooler than surrounding areas, but it's different enough to be surprising, she says. The 2 main potential explanations, the cold spot, either it's emitting less heat from the rest of the surface, or it takes longer to warm up in Europa's morning. The first could happen if the ice there has a different composition to that of the surrounding area, making it harder for heat to travel through it. The second could be a result of a blockier, less grainier texture. A large block of ice would take longer to warm up, much as ice sculptures can last an entire afternoon, but a bowl of ice cubes will melt within a few minutes. If the spot is real, I would expect that. This is really interesting because I think radiating fast is much faster like sunspots. It's much easier to get things to radiate more. If the spot is real, I would expect it to be a large sheet of ice, maybe younger than the rest of the surface because it hasn't been broken up yet. This is Jessica Novickel of Arizona State University. Quote, on Europa, I would be interested in studying something young to see what the moon really looked like at its early state and how it's changed over time. The model at Trumbo's team used to spot this anomaly was partially based on limited data from Galileo spacecraft on the area's albedo and reflectiveness. Because of that, Novickel and Julie Rathburn of the Planetary Science Institute of Arizona doubt that the cold spot is actually there. Quote, I looked over the Galileo data and there's no good data on that area, so we have no idea what it looks like, says Rathburn. Wowzer. Despite the lack of data, Trumbo insists that there is something odd going on. Quote, it's possible that our albedos are not 100% correct. Actually, it's likely, she says. But it would be strange if there was a wrong significantly in only one location without the spot being somehow different. Freaking out exactly how it is different, we'll have to wait for more data. Quote, now you can image almost anything, Trobo said. My issue is, it's 300 kilometers, how many pixels 300 kilometers that radio waves? It's just hard to do. And 2 out of 4 clues, it's just a bit shaky. Your typing could reveal Parkinson's. And can I say, since I've been recuperating, my typing speed has expanded. I've got to, but I can type quickly for short periods of time. Subtle clues on how you type on a keyboard may be able to reveal your early signs of Parkinson's. The hope is that you could help spot the disease before pronounced hand tremors of serious changed brain had occurred. To test the approach, hundreds of volunteers installed a program on their computers that monitored their typing over 9 months. Warwick Adams of Charles Sturt University, Australia, then whittled the sample down to 76 individuals who were the appropriate age, not taking medication, and who either didn't have Parkinson's or whose condition was of mild severity. Adam wanted to see if the times between key presses could be accurately plotted against the 4 to 6 hertz, the frequency of Parkinson hand tremors. If these data points didn't map well to such a curve, that would be an indication there's no tremor present. Using this technique, the system was able to correctly identify patients who had mild Parkinson's disease tremor with 78% accuracy. Quote, the end game is to develop a widely available screening test for both GPs and individuals, says Adams, who has Parkinson's himself, but not the tremors. Good on you, mate. Be nice to know how old you are. Early detection would, in theory, allow doctors to prescribe treatments that can inhibit the progression of the disease. About 3/4 of the people with Parkinson's develop hand tremors. Adam had previously developed a method of detecting early Parkinson's disease by spotting changes in the flow of someone's typing. He thinks combining the two methods will help build a diagnostic tool. However, one difficulty is the system will face is that mild tremors are almost pronounced when resting, not typing, says Alva Sanchez Ferro at the HM Sinet Comprehensive Neurosciences Center in Spain. Well, at least they're doing some checks on it. AI takes marble theory of mind tests. By Timothy Revell, News and Technology, with 36 minutes in. Do computers know what we are thinking? To find out, a team of the University of California, Berkeley, has created a set of grueling tests that probe AI's progress in understanding the world. None has passed the test yet, but one got very close. The test examines the theory of mind, the ability to reason about another's belief, and inspired by experiments in psychology. Each consists of a short paragraph describing a scenario involving people. For example, Sally hides a marble from Anne and moves it to a new location. Passing the test revolves around identifying first and second order beliefs. The first order belief, working out what someone else thinks and answering the question, where does Sally think the marble is? For example, a second order belief is someone who thinks someone else is thinking, for example. Where does Anne think Sally think the marble is? Children are normally able to correctly identify the first order beliefs around age 3, but this is at 7 or 6 that they can do the same for the second order beliefs. Adi Nejmatzadeh, who led the work at the Google AI's lab at DeepMind, and her colleagues generated 10,000 scenarios and the associated questions that tested the theory of mind via first and second order beliefs. They then put them to 4 state-of-the-art AIs. None managed to achieve a passing score, which is set at 95%. Most humans would be able to score 100%. The highest achiever was an AI called RealNet, produced by Adam Saunter and his colleagues at DeepMind, and scored 94.3%. Oh dear. And the other 3 AIs managed 92.94%. However, the results were fairly fickle. Inserting an unrelated sentence with no bearing on the test situations was enough to bamboozle the AIs. All of them dropped their scores between 5 and 20%, suggesting they weren't properly grasping the meaning of the text. This is bizarre. Though no AI yet displayed theory of mind, they are improving at an impressive rate. Only 2 years ago, Facebook produced a series of tests that would examine AI's ability to answer questions about the world. None of the tests could handle the task at the time, but some can now pass with few mistakes. A machine with theory of mind could prove useful, says Alan Wagner of Georgia Tech Research Institute in Atlanta. An AI teaching assistant might be able to reason about the student's false beliefs related to a course. For example, the final exam is next week, when it is in fact tomorrow, and in doing so be able to be better suited to help. Poor student. Another example is a self-driving car, says Jonas Berver at University of Copenhagen in Denmark. This is a bit of an eye-opener. An AI-driven car with a theory of mind might realize that the driver of another car has seen a person on the road and honk the horn to warn them, he says. However, if an AI can pass these tests, it may still not have a theory of mind, says Wagner. Some corals are beginning to beat the heat. Repeating an experiment 47 years after it was originally carried out revealed some rare good news about corals. Some species appear to be significantly better at surviving temperature increases. In 1970, marine zoologists collected three species of coral from the reef of Kainuki Bay, Hawaii. They put them in a chamber and gradually heated the water. They found they couldn't tolerate an increase of 1 to 2 degrees. They started to bleach, ejecting colourful algae that live within them. Without these, coral die. Overall, no corals from one species survived, and the survival rates were 40% and 5% for the others. But corals in the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology got a different result when he repeated the experiment using the same pieces of coral from the same area decades later. When he raised the temperature by the same amount, it took a few days longer for the corals to begin to bleaching, and more than half survived. That was a big surprise, quote, says Coles. The finding is in line with the anecdotal observations from reefs that some corals seem to be surviving bleaching. Cole doesn't know how they do it, but other research suggests some corals adapt to higher temperatures by associating with species of algae that are more tolerant of heat stress. It isn't clear that corals in Hawaii are individually acclimatizing to rising temperatures or whether they have genetically evolved to heat tolerance that they will pass on to future generations, says Kimahal Martz at the University of Texas Austin. Either way, it's good news, he says, although genetic adaptations may have more lasting benefits. Coles doesn't think the change will be enough to counteract the effects of global warming on coral, but suggests that if we take action on climate change, this is the buzzword, some coral reefs may still exist in 100 years' time, he says. Katrina Zimmer wrote that article. I have major issues with this. We're going to run out of steam here, 42 minutes in. Pram design cuts air pollution risk by Inga Vespa. Hello, Inga. High prams with canopies that shield the baby's head could go some way towards reducing exposure to dangerous particle pollution. That's a big idea, isn't it? An idea. By kitting out prams with air quality sensors and taking them for a stroll, the team at the University of Surrey, UK, is studying how much pollution babies are exposed to at the pram designs that are best incubating it. The team found that at higher prams, this is just incidentally, so I know the person who does did all the autopsies, and he said, mountains, pig lungs, plains, black lacy lungs. That was when we had the smelters and Wollongong coming across. And people who worked in the city, you could tell exactly what was going on. Okay. The team found that higher prams are better because most particle pollution is concentrated in the first metre above road level. On average, children in prams breathe at a height of 0.85 metres, meaning they are exposed to 60% more pollution than adults. On top of this, it doesn't mean anything, it just, results, I can't get the meaning of it. On top of this, particle pollution is more dangerous to infants than adults, says Jonathan Griggs of Queen Mary University of London, who is not involved in the study. Well, I have that. Babies breathe faster than adults and are more vulnerable to effects of pollution because the protective mechanism of their lungs are not yet fully developed, he says. When choosing the best pram for defending against pollution, the weather is also a factor. Hot summer air concentrates pollution close to the ground, making seat height particularly important. But when the air is cold, heat from the car exhaust whirls dangerous particles higher in the air, after which they descend. In these cases, prams with some sort of covering, such as a canopy or a plastic bad weather cover, can help protect the children from pollution falling down on them. Quote, there are very few existing studies to draw conclusive evidence on which pram design is best, says Frashant Kamar, who led the research. So far, he only is able to identify broad things to look for in a pram, but his team are running further tests until the end of September. Thank you. After which, the plan is to make a more detailed recommendations. In the future, it may be possible to purchase add-on air filter systems for prams. That's what they're obviously thinking. That's what I thought of. One currently in development is called the Brizzy. The device consists of a flat headrest with wings on either side of the baby's head. Air sucked in on one side is cleaned and blown out the other, creating a bubble of light, slightly higher pressure air which keeps out particles. Exposure to particle pollution damages the lungs and causes inflammation and long-term respiratory problems, they think. According to the UK government's clean air strategy, around 334,000 life years are lost in the country every year due to pollution. That's 50 million. You've got 50 million POMs. So that's, you're losing a couple of months of life. Sure. Designing better prams is only interim solution to tackling pollution, says Geeks. Quote, it's certainly prudent not to stick your child next to the exhaust pipe. But in the end, it's not about protecting babies, but technology by reducing emissions on the road, he says. Brains at full capacity stop noticing things, by Claire Wilson. Ever felt like you were struggling to think about too many things at once? That might be because your brain's attention systems are full. Brain scanning methods that show how much energy nerve cells are using provide support for an idea that have a finite amount of attention available. This offers an explanation for the bizarre, quote, invisible gorilla optical illusion, which people focus on one aspect of the stage video and fail to see a person in a gorilla suit. Nilia of the University College London, that's a very famous psychology picture. Neil Love of the University College of London took advantage of the new brain scanning method called broadband functional near infrared spectroscopy, which is developed as a way of measuring brain oxygen level with a simple headset. Wow. Infrared spectroscopy. I don't know how that works. Another group at UCL has tweaked the technology so instead of oxygen, it measures the activity of enzyme inside called mitochondria. The tiny structures that provide the cells with energy, quote, we're measuring the metabolism inside the neuron. In a latest experiment, participants did either an easy or hard version of a visual task that involved spotting certain shapes and colours on screen while wearing a headset. Half the time, they were also shown a flickering checkerboard pattern on the periphery of their vision. When the main task was easy, the brain cells dealing with the periphery vision raised their firing rates as the pattern started flashing. When the brain task was difficult, the flashing checkerboard pattern led to a little increase in neural activity. Quote, you suppress things you're not attending to, said Lai, who presented the findings of the recent UCL Neuroscience Symposium. Jean de Fourc of Goldsmiths University in London says other work has also shown the demands on our attention too, from one sense can also affect our senses too. 47 minutes in. Here we go. Okay. CRISPR article by Chelsea White. CRISPR helps dogs muscles disease. So, clustered, regularly interspaced palindromic repeats helps dogs muscles disease. CRISPR gene editing has been used to improve muscle function in dogs with conditions similar to Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, DMD. And the technique might one day lead to a treatment in humans. The study represents the first use of CRISPR gene editing in a living large animal. People with the DMD has a genetic mutation that makes them unable to produce dystrophin, a protein that maintains muscle structure and function. The condition can result in heart and lung failure. In 2010, Richard Peirce of the Royal Veterinary College in London and his colleagues identified the same mutation at Calavia King's Charles Spaniels that was brought into the veterinary hospital showing muscle weakness. They found the relatives of that dog and bred them with beagles. Three resulting pups have now been used to test the potential treatment for DMD. Today, there is only one approved DMD treatment to elevate dystrophin levels. In clinical trials, the drug treatment had modest effect. The people taking it could produce dystrophin, but only about 0.4% of the level seen in healthy individuals. The gene editing treatment has been able to restore 93% of the dystrophin expression in the beagle's heart tissue, 58% in the diaphragm, and 64% in the biceps. This method relies on CRISPR-Cas9, a genome editing enzyme that cuts the DNA at a specific spot, guided to the RNA. Well, Cas9 is the actual cutting enzyme, and you need some guided RNA in it. The team injected a virus carrying CRISPR and its RNA molecular guide into the skeletal muscle of the heart tissue of 1 to 2 months old beagles with DMD mutation. First time CRISPR had been used in live animals of large size, says Eric Olson, the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. 6 weeks later, they analyzed the dog's muscles and sequenced their genomes before comparing them with dogs of the same mutation and a healthy dog. Quote, "We looked through the microscope and saw a jaw-dropping," says Olson. "Virtually all the muscle fibers showed a high level of dystrophin underlying every membrane. We were exuberant." However, he says it's not known whether the treatment could have had such dramatic effects in human versions of the condition. Melissa Spence at the University of California, Los Angeles, says the results are a great first step towards treatment, but she cautions that they require more safety testing. Quote, "The Cas9 protein expresses for a long time, so the immune system could attack it." If it's buried inside the cell, I can't find it. We need a better assessment of the immune response, and we need to be sure CRISPR isn't cutting off target. Yeah, that's a more important thing. I've never heard of Cas9 allergy. Recent concerns have been raised that CRISPR does indeed cut off target, stepping up DNA where it's not supposed to. Olson says they didn't see evidence that that was happening in the dogs. The blood tests are normal after the treatment. Percy adds that he hopes the treatment could lead to a routine therapy for dogs with muscle disease as well. Fish passed the mirror test for the first time. Kinorhesty things, which are the fish which go up and clean the other big fish, has become the first fish to pass the mirror test, a classic experiment used to gauge self-awareness in animals. Until now, relatively intelligent animals, such as apes, elephants, have passed the test, which shows whether the individual can recognize itself. To see if the fish be self-aware, Masson Kondo at Osaka City University, Japan, and his colleagues put 10 wild cleaned rats in individual tanks with a mirror. During the first days, 7 of the fish attacked the mirror images, but these fish then began to dash towards the mirror and dance. Unusual behavior that had never been observed before. Well, that's as bizarre as I can ever say. The team put colored gel onto the heads of the 8 of these fishes. So the 10 fishes. There's 10 fishes, okay. 7 of the fish attacked the mirrors. And they put gel on the 8 of these fishes in positions that could only be using the mirror. 7 of the fishes spent significantly more time in front of the mirror in poses that sent the reserve mark on the head. Some even tried to scrub it off. According to the team, this means the clean rats and the successful at recognizing themselves as mirror in elephants. Oh, gee, that's really hard because these fish do try to clean off infections. Oh, no, I think this is bizarre. I disagree with this completely. Because if it thinks there's another fish, I'll just try and clean it off. I'll clean it off themselves rather than the image would be a bit different. That's true if they said that. Some even tried to clean it off, so to clean it, scrape it off their own head, that would be more available. However, Gordon Gallup of the University of Albany, who invented the mirror test, is not convinced. Kenna rats eat parasites and living on other fish. These rats probably mistook the marks for parasites on the skin of other fish, Gallup says. Now, I think this is poor. There's no score. Firstly, that's really confusing. 10, 8, 7. That's really confusing. Why just 7? Why 8? Why not all of them? I find it really hard to work out what's going on there. 54. Wolves may have influenced when elks shed their antlers. Each spring, male elks lose their antlers so they can grow back bigger and stronger ones to fight rival mates in autumn. You'd think Alright. It turns out wolves may have helped shape the evolution of the ptarmigan. If elks lose their antlers too soon, they risk ending up as wolf food rises. The risk of ending up as wolf food rises, i.e. that the elks stop them being, the antlers stop them being eaten by wolves too late, and they may fail to win a mate. Matthew Mintz of the University of Montana colleague analysed 55 encounters between male elk and wolves in Yellowstone National Park, with the bears being shot like flies. In 2004 to 2016, we found the elks shed their antlers early were also the most vulnerable to wolf attacks. Look, I just find this crazy. In 18 cases, the wolves attacked a lone male, and the presence and lack of antlers made no difference. But the remaining 37 encounters involved attacks on groups of two or more male elks. The wolves target stags without the antlers. Okay. Groups containing at least one antlerless male animal were 10 times more likely to be attacked. The finding was also meant to apply to related species. Okay, that's... It'd be nice if they had a graphic for it. Elks don't have a choice about when they shed their antlers. It's probably linked to testosterone level, but shedding early seems to carry long-term benefits for potential short-term but fatal cost. Quote, we suggest that wolves, formerly everywhere across the Northern Hemisphere, have shaped the timing of when elk shed their antlers to mets. Opioid blocks pain and addiction. New opioid drug has been... New opioid drug has been shown to stop monkeys feeling pain without the apparent addictive and harmful side effects. I wonder if there's different types of opioids which knock out addiction pathways. Okay. Opioids such as morphine stop pain but also are addictive. In the US alone, more than 46 people die daily from overdose prescription opioids. That's a bloody fucking lot. Mi-Chan Ko of Wake Forest University in North Carolina and his colleagues have found that a drug called AT-121 blocks pain by activating two types of opioid receptors in the brain. There you go. One is the mu opioid receptor, the pain relieving receptor targeted by many opioids. The other is nociceptin opioid receptor, which blocks the brain's addiction forming response, while also providing pain relief. So you think you could do that for almost any drug. The drug was 100 times as good as morphine at reducing pain in monkeys. No addictive properties were seen. I was just trying to think. Either my drug that they're putting on, there's a drug that they gave me on patch. I've really forgotten the name of the drug. There you go. Brain is just a sieve. A warm water time bomb threatens the Antarctic. Okay. The Arctic in hot water, literally. The Arctic is in hot water, literally. Heat has been accumulating rapidly in the salty layers 50 metres down in a large part of the Arctic Ocean. Currently, it's capped by a less dense layer of fresh water. Well, what's wrong with that? Because the less dense will stay at the top. But fears that winds could make this lid fall apart. If the two layers mix, you can melt all the seasonal ice above. So the hot water is a layer of salty water. Oh, heat. Okay, so heat. This layer has been heating up. So normally, anything. So this is the reverse of the Arctic fall. So what's happened is it's salty, it's still hot. I find this hard to believe. Okay. Mary Louise Timson at Yale University and her colleagues discovered the heat time bomb after analysing data on ice cover and sea temperature. Heat content of saltiness at different depths over the past 3 decades in the Canadian basin, which is fed by the waters of the North Churchy Sea, north of the Bering Strait between Alaska and Siberia. The team found that the heat content of a 100 meter thick salty layer had doubled over this time. I find the heat I wonder what the heat content is. That's kilojoules. To double the heat content, you'd double the temperature. I don't quite understand. The root cause of the global warming, which is the Arctic surface temperature rise by 2 degrees from pre-industrial levels, leading to a record low sea ice coverage. The sea ice is retreating. Heat absorption of the surface water has increased fivefold in 30 years. The team found strong winds push the newly warmed surface waters at the Arctic fringes down to depths that they are now accumulating under the ice. I'm just really trying to find and understand that. Serengeti, shaped by ancient herders, I really need a computer simulation if they could do that with it. Serengeti grasslands are far from pristine works of nature. In fact, their rich biodiversity may owe more to cowpats from livestock corralled overnight by millennial nomadic herders millennia ago. Dung. Such dung has long been known to provide a hotspot for nutrients in otherwise barren grassland, eventually enabling much richer ecosystems to develop. It was assumed that, on Serengeti, because of these spots, called grassy glades, date back roughly 1,000 years. Fiona Marshall of Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and her colleagues have shown that they may be much older. The team sampled 5 sites in Kenya and found evidence of dung and richer soils dating back 3,700 years. Here we go. Look, I think I'm going to reach my end here. I'm just on now. I'll just read one more over the top. What? Oh, God. Okay. So as quantum physicist, I find this really hard to stomach, but it could be true. I can't believe it. A machine to split the electron. Surfs up. Electrons riding in a plasma wave can be accelerated through high energy, which may let us build a small particle accelerator, smash them up, and learn more about the tiniest objects in the universe. The world's largest accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN Particle Physics Laboratory in Geneva, Switzerland, smashes protons by whizzing them around a 27-kilometer ring, but won't work for electrons. The main is because there's synchrotron radiation. They have to be accelerated in a straight line. Well, they still radiate when they're accelerated, but the... Okay, advanced proton-driven plasma wake field acceleration experiment. Also at CERN gets, I wonder what it's, APDPWA, well, I don't know what it's anything. By shooting hundreds of billions of protons into a tube filled with rubidium atoms, rubidium, they have been stripped of their electrons, forming a plasma. The result is the waves in the plasma that when the electrons are injected into the tube, the waves accelerate them. Container used just 10 meters long and the electrons at the end reach, wow, 2 GeV. Electrons are fundamental particles, meaning we think they won't break down into anything smaller, but we don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. To this, it would require smashing electrons at 100 GeV. Which could be done using higher energy protons. Okay, they're nowhere near close. Okay, that ends my reading of an hour in. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.